The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Elvis, Cher, Ben Harper, Jimi Hendrix, Chuck Norris, Tori Amos, Angelina Jolie, all people who share not only fame, but the claim of being one part Cherokee. More Americans claim descent from at least one Cherokee ancestor than any other Native American group. Why? Well, Gregory Smithers has been examining that very question and wrote about it for Slate. He's associate professor of history at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of The Cherokee Diaspora. Gregory Smithers, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me.
So just how many Americans claim to have Cherokee blood?
Well, that number keeps increasing each year. According to the Census Bureau in 2010, there were a little under 820,000 Americans who self-identified as having at least one Cherokee ancestor. That was up quite substantially from the 2000 census, which enumerated 730,000 Americans who self-identified as Cherokee. I should add to that that there are approximately 200 to 220 organizations and groups around the country who the Eastern Band of Cherokee categorize as fraud groups. That is, groups who claim to be Cherokee, but according to the Eastern Band of Cherokees in North Carolina, have no legitimate claim to making that claim for themselves.
Well, many Native American groups do call for extensive proof of heritage. Any idea of how many of those who claim Cherokee heritage can actually back it up in their ancestry?
It's very difficult, and part of the problem is that the three federally recognized Cherokee tribes have different qualification standards for membership or citizenship within their nations. So, for example, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma requires that one trace their ancestors back to the Dawes Rolls from 1899 through 1906. They don't have any minimum blood quantum requirement, but they do require one to have an ancestor appear on those rolls that were collected during that period. That's often very difficult because that's a period when people were migrating and moving around the American West, looking for employment, looking for land to farm on. And so going to one of these federally recognized sites where they could enroll themselves was not a high priority for a lot of people who are merely trying to survive. So it's very difficult for a lot of people then to find the paper trail because it often does not exist.
Well, let's look at why claiming Cherokee origins in particular. First, a little history of the Cherokee people. What do we know about their origins?
Well, the Cherokee people are an Iroquois-speaking people. Most of the scholars who study the Cherokee argue that they migrated and settled in the southeast many, many hundreds of years ago prior to European contact in the 1500s or the 16th century. And they had a long history after settling in the southeast, traditional lands that stretch through the Carolinas and hunting lands up through southwestern Virginia, Kentucky, settlements in Tennessee. It's a vast territory, and in that vast territory, they had a long history of intermarrying and adopting outsiders. Now, after Europeans began to arrive on a continuous and systematic basis in the 17th century, Cherokee people tended to adopt and or intermarry with European men, English, French on some occasions, and very rarely Spanish men. These men were more often than not traders, and those traders were looking to access trade networks among the Cherokee, and they believed that in a marriage with a Cherokee woman, and bear in mind this is a matrilineal society we're talking about, would open up those networks for them. As a result of those intermarriages, what we had was a growing population of mixed-race people, not all of whom stayed with and lived a life, a communal life as a Cherokee, but very often did retain some vague sense that they had been born to an interracial couple. At the same time, we also have Europeans and Euro-Americans who are adopted by the Cherokee, and most famously, during the late 18th, early 19th century period, figures like Sam Houston, who goes on to become one of the founding members of the Republic and later state of Texas, is himself adopted as a member of the Overhill Cherokee in modern-day Tennessee.
Well, I used to live in New Orleans, where a number of people of African descent used to say they were not black, but Indian, many saying Cherokee. So what is the history of unions between the Cherokee and African Americans?
Yeah, there is a relationship there, and that goes back to the history of slavery among the Cherokee people. Cherokee people, like other Southeastern Native Americans, did practice a system of captivity in which captives or outsiders would be taken and serve a period of servitude or slavery, but then later after their period of service would be adopted into the responsibilities of clan membership. That began to change at the end of the 18th and early 19th century when the Cherokee people adopted racial slavery. And that's when you have this period of African-American people being purchased as chattel or as commodities by Cherokee slaveholders. And it gets to the point where by about the 1820s and 30s, there's a little over 7% of the Cherokee population who own slaves. Some of them have quite large plantations, and there does seem to be a degree of intermixture that goes on. In some cases, some couples live as man and wife, common law man and wife, and they do have children. So it's from this rather complicated history of sometimes illicit relationships and then also the history of racial slavery among the Cherokee that we do have these stories of African-American people claiming descent from Cherokee ancestors. And very often, the story goes in African-American vernacular history that they are descended from princesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, of course, a critical chapter in Cherokee history, the Trail of Tears, when some 17,000 Cherokees forced from their homelands at the end of the 1830s. They moved on to the Indian territories in Oklahoma. There's a tragic history there, certainly, but is there a kind of romanticism in being part of that persecuted people?
I think there is, and that's something that has emerged very strongly, I think, since the 1970s, in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, when there were many American ethnic groups who were looking for some sort of history that would enable them to lay claim to what some scholars have referred to as an ethnic revival. And we did see during the removal process and what came to be called the Trail of Tears, Cherokee people removed in communities that were ethnically and racially diverse. So you do have intermarried whites moving with their Cherokee families. We also have enslaved people, African Americans, moving with their Cherokee masters and their families through the Trail of Tears, either by overland route or by water to Indian territory. So there is a degree of both romanticism, but also another story to Cherokee removal that is much more diverse and complicated, and in many ways much more traumatic for a multitude of groups who came to be called Cherokee during the 19th century.
We're talking with Gregory Smithers, who's written a book called The Cherokee Diaspora about the history of this tribe in particular and its intermixing that may have given people some claim to Cherokee heritage. How about on the other side of the racial divide, there are incidences of white Southern racists, even KKK members claiming to be part Cherokee. What do you think is going on there?
Well, this also has a very long history, and one of the things that we saw in the wake of removal at the end of the 1830s were white Southerners claiming for themselves a Cherokee identity. So in the 1840s and 1850s, we had this sudden upsurge, quite extraordinary, of white Southerners, mainly men, claiming that they were descended from regal Cherokee bloodlines. And I suspect what's going on there, and I'm not alone in suspecting this, is that those Southern men were claiming a degree of legitimacy, trying to legitimate an ancient claim on the land, but not so racially divergent from the white norm that it would undermine their claim to being part of the master race in the South in the 1840s and 50s. I think in the decades since then, and certainly in the 20th century, what we've seen is the appropriation of Cherokee imagery in popular culture, in consumer markets. It's got to the point now over the past generation or two that you can see the word Cherokee branded on everything from children's clothing to medical scrubs to automobiles. And I think that kind of visibility lends itself to people appropriating that identity to try and legitimate both their sense of American nativity, a rootedness in the soil, and to lay claim to say, hey, you know, I've got ancestors who were also persecuted in the past and by the federal government, no less.
Well, we've talked a lot about the intermixing that would lead people to believe that they might have some Cherokee blood. But, you know, I'm not sure I really understand why people would shift their identity to claim ownership of the Cherokee Nation.
Well, I think it's something that every school child from a very early age is exposed to the narrative, even in its simplest form, of Cherokee removal. And I think it engenders a degree of empathy or sympathy on the part of the Cherokee for that rather brutal and inglorious history that they experienced. And it may be that some Americans at a very young age internalize the suffering and experience and incorporate it into their own ethnic identity, whether explicitly or implicitly as they grow into adulthood. I also think that, I mean, it is the case that there are towns and counties throughout the United States that are called Cherokee. There are Cherokee counties, for example, in Texas, in Alabama, in Iowa. And in many cases, and speaking to people throughout the years, they were told growing up that they had Cherokee ancestors. And when they did their family tree and looked into their genealogies, what they discovered was that their great-great-grandmother was in actuality not a Cherokee princess or had Cherokee blood, but in actuality had been born in Cherokee County, Iowa, or Cherokee County, Texas. So it is much like a game of telephone for many families, I think, that these stories sort of begin in the 19th century and are passed on and grow to the proportion of legend, and people accept them as part of their family lore.
Now we hear of challenges to people claiming tribal identity of various sorts when it comes to benefits or scholarships or even casino profits. How do the Cherokee people of the official Cherokee Nation feel about so many people claiming Cherokee identity?
Well, the Cherokee people are very protective of those resources. They, on one hand, find it ironic that casino revenues have now made it possible for Cherokee people, for instance, in Oklahoma, to fund healthcare programs, housing programs, educational programs that benefit their communities, But at the same time, and this is on the other hand, they have outsiders, often white Americans, who will cynically look at the use of casino revenue, for instance, as an example of how these are not people acting in an authentic or traditional Cherokee or even more broadly Native American cultural way. And that is something that, again, many Cherokee people look at as an expression of white privilege, white supremacy, because in the communities, these are people themselves who can still remember the grinding poverty of less than a generation ago, where many communities in eastern Oklahoma, for instance, did not have basic essentials for life, such as running water. And the profits from casino revenue have made that possible in some cases. So it's simply a matter of using, from a Cherokee perspective, resources, gambling resources and revenues to make communal life possible, sustainable, and to encourage creativity and indeed to revitalize things like language and traditional cultural practices.
Gregory Smithers, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Gregory Smithers, he's Associate Professor of History at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of The Cherokee Diaspora. We do have a link to read his article on why so many Americans claim that they have Cherokee blood. The link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Conventional wisdom holds that counting tree rings reveals the age of a tree, but those rings hold so much more information. One Virginia scientist reads tree rings to learn about historical weather patterns and to put our current climate into a larger context. Lilia Fukin reports.
Some of the largest trees in the world have been making the news lately.
California's historic drought has created a long list of problems for the Golden State, including killing millions of trees in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Now, even the iconic giant sequoias are starting to show signs that they're not getting enough water.
3,000 miles away, at Radford University, tree ring scientist Stockton Maxwell is worried about them too.
Out in the western United States, we have some pretty charismatic trees. They're just these beautiful beasts of trees growing on the landscape. Species like the giant sequoia, the giant redwoods. But now might be a time where it's historically dry over the past several hundred years, and they might not be able to survive some of these intense droughts that we're currently seeing.
Stockton is a dendrochronologist, or as he calls himself, a tree ringist. He spends countless hours in the forest finding really, really old trees and then deciphers the stories encoded in their trunks.
As a tree ring scientist, I see fissures in the bark and big, thick limbs, and I think, oh, there's an old tree. I wish I had my increment borer. I want to sample it. It's probably can tell me something about the past. Tree rings can solve all the world's problems if I could convince you.
Of course, the main character in every tree ring story is water. Basically, the more water available to the tree, the more it grows and the thicker the ring. This allows scientists to track weather patterns through the ages.
We need a long-term context of how much water has been flowing through these ecosystems. If we don't, we could get in trouble as the climate changes. You kind of got to know where you've been to know where you're going, if you know what I mean.
But the trees with the thickest trunks aren't necessarily the oldest.
The diameter or the width of that tree, it might only be 10 inches, but it has 500, 600, 700 growth rings on it. And it's just amazing to look at because you will see a growth ring that might be only 2 cells wide. And you just have to imagine what happened in that year that caused that tree to grow so slowly.
Take, for example, Prometheus.
Prometheus is a bristlecone pine.
This gnarly, scrubby pine tree had been growing way up high in the White Mountains of the California-Nevada region for, apparently, thousands of years.
But scientists, dendrochronologists, didn't know that until we had a few people go up into the mountains, see these trees, and then begin to sample them.
In 1964, the Forest Service gave a young scientist permission to take core samples and cut down one tree for his research. The tree they dispatched with a chainsaw has become known as Prometheus.
They found out after they brought it back to the lab that it was the longest-lived single tree and single organism above ground known at that time, living almost 5,000 years.
The unfortunate incident has made a lasting impact on the scientific community, even contributing to the knowledge of carbon dating.
It was a revelation that there were trees that were out on the landscape for that long recording the environment.
These days, Stockton has been studying trees much closer to home, in the central Appalachian region.
The trees are really telling us that we are in a very moist time in the past 50 to 100 years in this region of the Mid-Atlantic. And when we look back to all the way back into the 1600s, we see periods that were much drier in the past and maybe have been drier for longer periods of time, whereas now it's pretty wet and we don't really face the challenges that we might have in the past.
So while the parched trees of the Pacific coast may be facing a very dry future, at least for now, the trees of central Appalachia are growing nice fat rings.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the stunning Chauvet cave paintings to the legend of the Trojan War to Black Beauty, horses have captured the human imagination across millennia. But as humans, it moved from simply observing and sketching wild horses to domesticating them for work and for sport. We lost a fundamental understanding of their behavior. Or so argues Wendy Williams in her new book, The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companions. Wendy's going to be reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Thursday at 7. But first, I'm so pleased to welcome her back to Word of Mouth. Hello, Wendy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and really excited about this book. I mean, I, like many people, have considered myself a horsey person for a long time, but learned so much here. It's kind of a big epic history. So let's
Well, you know, I have to tell you that although I've lived my whole life with horses, I'm 65 now, and I learned all kinds of things writing this book, so I'm not surprised.
Well, let's dive into this. I mean, can that love of horses be explained biologically? Are human beings kind of hardwired to love horses?
In a sense, I think you're right. I think we are. I think there's just something magical about the S-curve that goes from the ears all the way down to the tail that is attractive to us on a really basic mathematical level. And I think we also relate to them really well because they are very social animals like us. Just the way that humans live in family groups, horses, it turns out, also live in very small groups called bands. And the basis of these bands are sometimes family ties, and sometimes it's just the mares like to have a lot of girlfriends around that they enjoy being with.
How are these small groups formed?
You know, they're formed in a number of ways. Sometimes it has to do with a family relationship, but sometimes it just has to do with the mares grew up with other mares and never parted ways. Sometimes a mare might come from some other band and decide that she likes the mares in this particular band and stick around. One of the things that I thought was really interesting in the research that I did was to find out that the stallion has a lot less central role in the safety and well-being of the band than we previously thought. The stallion is important, and there is almost always a stallion with a band of mares, but he doesn't run the show the way we used to think.
Well, there are stories that you tell of the distinction between mares and stallions, one of a free-roaming mare in Wyoming. But first, tell us, what is free-roaming, not wild?
You know, I use the words free roaming and free ranging a lot. Sometimes I use the word wild. I don't use the word feral. The word wild has certain connotations for people, and I think sometimes those connotations can confuse the discussion. There really isn't, genetically speaking, that much difference between horses that are out on the American plains running on their own and the horses that we have in the barn.
So genetically, they may be identical, but you have seen some differences in behavior between the free-ranging and domesticated horses in a couple of different scenarios, including witnessing Mustangs in New Hampshire. Now, first of all, there are Mustangs in New Hampshire? I had no idea.
Yes, I was very surprised to find that out myself. And what the Coco family does is rehabilitate Mustangs who have been adopted by people and who have not been able to really take care of the Mustangs very well for one reason or another. They haven't had the right facilities and they haven't had enough knowledge. And the Coco Farm has a great deal of expertise in knowing how to care for these horses. One of the very interesting things that they do is let them roam out in their fields all year round. They don't bring them in the wintertime. They don't blanket them. They don't brush them. They let them do their Mustang thing. Even last winter in all that incredible snow, the horses were out on their own, and they did fine. Stephanie Coco, the matriarch of the household there, told me that what they do when it's cold, they just walk. She said they get together in groups, and they just walk and walk and pace. If I had to pick one difference between horses kept in a barn and horses allowed to roam freely, I would say that the free-roaming horses tend to be extremely curious animals.
And it also, I thought it was kind of interesting that there's a sort of age range inside of these bands often.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what you might see is the older mares who are wiser, more experienced, and more stable. Mm-hmm. Might form the sort of core of the group, kind of like in real life. And the foals are born and stay with that band for a short amount of time and then disappear to go off to find their fortune elsewhere. And you might find that they might come back after a while, just as we do, or they might not. They might have found a permanent bond somewhere else where they decide to stay. So it really depends on the individual animal. Some, just as in real life, just as with human beings, some people want to stay home where they were born and some people want to roam the world. Horses are the same way.
Is there a hierarchy within these groups?
I think not. What science is telling us is that within a core group of mares, you may find not so much of a hierarchy as a give and take. That some mares may very strongly want such and such thing. They may decide they want to go for a drink of water, and the other mares will follow along. Then a whole separate mare will decide that she wants to go somewhere with better grass, and those mares will follow along. So it really, really depends on what's going on at the moment as to who makes the decision.
Wendy Williams is with us. She previously joined us on Word of Mouth to talk about the kraken, the cephalopods, and our human fascination with them. Well, now she's talking with us about the horse. She's written an epic history of our noble companions. I wonder what that means for group safety. You know, in a group of antelopes, you travel all together and the decisions are made together because there are probably possibly tigers, you know, or lions out there ready to get you. How about with groups of horses?
I think when it comes to issues of safety that they're probably very much in unison as far as what they can and can't do. I suspect that if an enemy came, a mountain lion in the American West, for example, that the horses might very quickly become unified into one group. Some say that that's where the stallion does come in handy because the stallion may turn and fight the invader mountain lion and the other mares may watch, and some mares may actually help. Some ethologists, some people who study horse behavior in the wild, have seen mares actually pitch in and help to fight off dangerous predators.
All right, so this is bringing me full circle back around to this story of Hightail the mare, a free-roaming mare in Wyoming. Please just tell us a little bit about her.
Oh, I love the story of Hightail. It just warmed my heart. I think one of the reasons that I liked Hightail so much is that when we saw her, the ethologist who took me to see her had data from at least 10 years. So the scientists know a lot about who she is or who she has been, her backstory, as I say in the book. When we saw her, she was a pretty aged mare and didn't look so great. She needed to put on a little bit more weight. She could have done with a shampooing and someone to fluff up her mane and tail. She looked pretty worn out, and she was eating just food that I would never have thought that a horse would eat. Just absolutely the dregs of the dregs. But her backstory was really very dramatic and quite romantic. She grew up and made a first attachment with a stallion, and she left the band to be with this stallion, and they roamed the world for a while. Then another stallion came by and stole Hightail from stallion number one, and Hightail didn't really want to be with stallion number two, so she kept running off, and stallion number two kept attacking her and forcing her to come back with him. But eventually he gave up, and as soon as his back was turned, she took off and went back with stallion number one, because that's the stallion that she wanted to be with. Her life had many vagaries after that. She ended up in a lot of other places and was companioned with stallion number three for a while. But eventually that stallion, as I say in the book, fell from grace. No one really knew what happened with him. So the next time the scientists saw her, she was back with stallion number one. Mm. And she stayed with stallion number one until he died.
Well, it implies a sort of willfulness, or one of the observers called it subtle deceit.
There was some subtle deceit. Yes, there was some subtle deceit.
What would be an example of that?
Well, the story that I love most in that, as you know from reading the book, the Jason Ransom, the ethologist I worked with, and I went over to Spain, to the northwestern corner of Spain, to a place called Galicia, where there are free-roaming horses that have a deep history. Maybe they are the original free-roaming horses from which a great deal of our modern horses come. We don't know for sure. But they're still there in the mountains of Galicia, living their lives, fighting off the wolves. And Lara Lagos is a young ethologist who is working with a senior ethologist, Felipe Barcena.
And what do ethologists do, if you could remind me?
Yes. An ethologist is a scientist who studies the natural behavior of animals in the wild. And Lara had watched two particular mares who were very good companions. They were part of a band, but they had special bonds within that band. And when it came time to mate, the two mares went off on their own together to visit with a stallion of another band. And one mare mated, and then the two mares came back to their original band, and it was time for the second mare to mate. They left again. They went off to the other stallion of the other band. She mated, and then they came back. So Lara was quite astonished by this behavior and watched what they did the next year at the same time, and she saw exactly the same behavior. So this kind of intense bonding, it really can't be explained by anything that we previously knew about horses, but we know it can persist over quite a long time.
So they're willing partners. I guess it's easy to project, when hearing these stories, personality onto a horse. I don't know if that's too anthropomorphic, but how complex are these emotions and personalities of horses? As an equestrian, have you experienced that for yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my regrets was not having had the information that I have now. I didn't really understand in depth what I was seeing. But absolutely, horses have very, very complex personalities, at least as complex as dogs, or as complex as us. Like dogs and like humans, horses live in small groups where personal bonds are really, really important for their survival.
I was thinking also of a horse that you had, Whisper.
Oh. Whisper.
Yeah, what can you tell us about Whisper?
Well, Whisper was the result of my lifelong yearning for a horse. When I got out of college, I could finally act on that, and Whisper came into my care after I had graduated from school, and I rented a house with a barn. But I'm living in Vermont, and it's January. It's minus 10 degrees as a matter of routine in the night where I was living. And I got up one morning and I had my coffee, and I thought, well, I think I just need another cup of coffee before I go out and tackle the barn. So I poured myself another cup of coffee very indulgently and looked out my kitchen window, and I saw Whisper come sailing over the fence and come right up to the water spigot, which was on the side of the house in front of the kitchen window. And Whisper took a hoof, and he went bang, 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 and on went the water. I'm very lucky that the water actually went on, because if it hadn't, he could very well have broken the spigot. The reason he knew about that was because I had thought earlier in the year when it was warmer that I was being very clever in bringing the horses up to the water spigot instead of running the water down. I had to carry it down in buckets. Instead of carrying it down in buckets, I had brought the horses up to drink their fill. So he knew where the water came from, and when he was thirsty, he decided to get it for himself.
Such a sweet story. You know, right now, horses are no longer needed so much for labor or for transport in most parts of the world. So what does that mean for our relationship with horses? Will we see more, you know, wild roaming horses? Can they ever be truly wild in our mind again?
Well, I think they are plenty wild now when they're allowed to be out on their own. I really think there's no difference between the domestic horses we have in stables and the wild horses roaming out in the various areas all over the world, really, that manage on their own. You'll find some visual differences. They, if left on their own devices, they aren't quite as big as the ones we've bred to be big, or they're not as glowing. They may not have special gaits that make people feel that they're extremely elegant, but really, beauty's only skin deep. The essential horse is the essential horse, and it's there whether we're dealing with them in the barn or whether we're dealing with them out on the range.
Wendy Williams, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been lots of fun. Thanks for asking me.
Wendy Williams is a journalist and equestrian and author of The Horse, an epic history of our noble companions. You can see her in person reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord this Thursday evening. There are details at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before there were nature documentaries, before there were zoos or big top traveling circuses, there were species of animals that had never had a reason, never mind ability, to travel to North America. So for those unwitting pioneers, the New World was probably a very lonely place. Nate DeMeo is host of the podcast The Memory Palace. In this episode, he chronicles the story of the first elephant to set foot in North America.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. She first set foot on America in November of 1795. We know this. It says so in the logbook of a trading ship called America, which set sail from Calcutta a month later. And we know the ship's captain paid $450 for her, which was a big investment. Add to that the cost of food and of revenue lost by taking up space that could have been stocked with barrels of spices and bolts of fabric and non-perishable things, instead of using it to transport a live elephant. The captain had big plans for her. We know this from letters he wrote to his four brothers, the sons of the George Crown and Shield and Sons shipping firm of Salem, Massachusetts. He thought people would flip out about an elephant back home, because there had never been one back home. Never been a single elephant on the whole continent of North America. He figured that had to be worth more than a crate of Darjeeling tea or cardamom. He bet he could turn his $450 into $5,000, easy. We don't know if he did. The historical record loses track of the elephant after a while. Newspapers tell us she drew crowds in New York right after the America returned to America. She stood tied to a stake at the corner of Broadway and Beaver downtown, and people paid to see her stand there. And we know that the captain brought her down south when winter came to get her out of the northern cold, the Carolinas being as close to India as he could offer. After that, we don't really know what happens to her for a while. But we do know about Hakaliah Bailey. Hakaliah Bailey's family owned a farm in what is now a bedroom community about an hour and change from Manhattan on the Metro North commuter line. In his early 30s, Hakaliah worked as a drover, bringing cattle into the city, such as it was at the start of the 19th century. It was a longer trip then. And at some point during one of his cattle drives, Hakaliah became enthralled with one of the animals that lived at the stockyard in Manhattan. He'd talk about her all the time when he was at home, and he'd go to see her every time he came to town. We don't know how she came to live with the cattle and pigs and sheep and goats, or how long she lived there. But we know that around 1807, Hakaliah Bailey bought an Indian elephant for $1,000, and brought her home to live on a farm in Somers, New York. He called her Betty. Bailey never liked farming. It was monotonous. It took forever for things to grow. It took forever to plow a field with a team of mules. But with an elephant, he ought to be able to cut forever in half. Just slap a yoke on Betty and get cracking. We don't know how well that went. What we do know is that an Indian elephant in rural America draws a crowd, particularly in 1807. And Hakaliah Bailey soon figured out that there was more money to be made by drawing a crowd than by increasing agricultural output through elephant-based efficiencies. So Hakaliah Bailey and the elephant he now affectionately called Old Bed hit the road. For the better part of a decade, they toured the Northeast, commandeering town squares and barns and charging people to see her. After a while, Bailey expanded the operation, turned it into a full-on traveling circus, adding a horse and a dog and a goat, which everyone had. But an elephant? No one had an elephant. Here were farmers and candlestick makers and coopers and their wives and their neighbors, people who hadn't left their fields or their town since they'd first emigrated, or since they'd gotten back from the war. Here were children who'd never been anywhere, never seen anything beyond the world of their farm and their town and their woods and their streams. And into that world walks this creature. Into that world walks the world. We don't know how much money Hakaliah Bailey made off Old Bet. We know there were times that the two of them would roll into a town and the people couldn't even scrounge a collective $10. And they'd trade farm tools and booze for a peek at the pachyderm. And we read, though we're not sure that we entirely believe, that the Indian elephant developed a taste for Jamaican rum. We know Hakaliah Bailey started walking Old Bet from town to town in the middle of the night, so people wouldn't get a free look along the way. We know he was successful enough to sell 2 shares of Old Bet for $1,200 apiece. We know those things. And we know, and are sad to report, that Old Bet died in Alfred, Maine in 1816. She was about 20. She was shot by a farmer who felt it was a sin to charge people to see an animal. We, of course, don't know how Old Bet felt about anything. But there are some things we do know. An Indian elephant in the wild can live up to 70 years. Evolution has made them fundamentally social animals. They eat, they breed, they find water, they protect themselves and their young and each other from predators by working together as a group. That they communicate through body language, by secreting fluids with decipherable odors, by growling and stamping and trumpeting and shrieking, and emitting sounds at frequencies so low that they can't be heard by humans, but that vibrate through the ground to be picked up by other elephants as far as 6 miles away. We know that their social order and group and individual survival hinge on their famous memories. Researchers have seen elephants reunited after 26 years signal that they recognize each other as family. Others remember distant watering holes that remain full even during times of drought, even when the last drought was more than 20 years before. And all elephants can recognize and remember as many as 200 individual elephants. So which did she remember? Which did she look for among the cattle and the hogs at the Manhattan stockyards? Into which did she send subsonic messages to radiate out through New England granite, only to fall 7,000 miles short? And what did she remember of the ship's hold, in the salt air of the Indian Ocean, in the Cape of Good Hope, in the mouth of the Hudson, of the countless days tied to a stake, of the green hills of North Carolina, of the faces in crowds, of the nights walking under stars and quarter moons and North American elms, to yet another strange place with no elephants?
And that was Nate DeMeo. He's host of the podcast The Memory Palace. You'll find a link to hear more of that podcast at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth, and on Twitter at wordofmouth. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor. If you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it. And as we know, the most interesting stories and ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.